From WYPR, I'm Sheila Cast. We're on the record. FDR's New Deal shaped Democratic politics for generations, but the roots of the coalition that made it happen stretch back further. Al Smith, the first Catholic nominated for president, carried the Democrats' banner in 1928. He drew ethnics and African Americans new to voting for Democrats. Historian Robert Childs says Smith ran on ideas he'd honed as governor of New York.
One of his first initiatives was to try and create a statewide compulsory health insurance program, partly funded by the state, partly funded by employers, and partly funded by labor. This was denounced as Bolshevism, and it was defeated by the Red Scare, basically.
Childs' book is The Revolution of 28, on the record after the news.
You're listening to On the Record, the podcast, a service of your public radio, 88.1 WYPR. Find more podcasts online at wypr.org. And tell us what you think. Send an email to ontherecord@wypr.org.
Good morning, I'm Sheila Cast. We're On the Record. Of course, we know about the New Deal, the surge in government programs set in the 1930s that radically restructured government's role in the economy. Arguably, much of today's political tension stems from that same debate over government's role. It's with us still. And where did the New Deal come from? Grew straight out of the 1929 stock market crash and the Great Depression, right? Didn't Franklin Roosevelt, campaigning in the spring of 1932, declare, quote, "the country demands bold, persistent experimentation," close quote. That's the same speech in which FDR said it's common sense to pick an approach, try it, and if it doesn't work, try something else. Sounds very ad hoc, very of the moment. Our guest today contends the roots of the New Deal and the political coalition behind it stretch back further, before the National Depression. Robert Childs' new book is The Revolution of 28, Al Smith, American Progressivism, and the Coming of the New Deal. Robert Childs teaches history at the University of Maryland and sometimes at Loyola University, Maryland, and Goucher College, and he's with me in the studio. Welcome to On the Record.
Thanks for having me, Sheila.
So before we get into the specifics, was that a fair summary of your thesis that during the Roaring Twenties, before the crash, that the Democratic Party had already picked a candidate with a record of vigorous government intervention?
Well, I think that that is right at the state level. Smith had indeed embraced a lot of things that we would later associate with New Deal liberalism as governor of New York. And when he ran for president in 1928, he was talking about taking those issues to the national level, because even though we think of the 20s as the Roaring Twenties, there were a lot of people suffering even before the stock market crashed in 1929, and there were already those, especially Smith, who were looking at ways to use the government to assuage some of that suffering.
So tell us about Al Smith.
Well, his background is fascinating, and I think it's probably the main reason that he becomes the kind of politician he does. He was born in poverty in New York City. He grew up on the Lower East Side of Manhattan in those immigrant enclaves. When he was in what today we would say middle school, he had to drop out of school because his father passed away, and he became the primary breadwinner for his family. His mother also worked, but he became the breadwinner. He started working 12-hour days starting at 4 in the morning as a young teen. So he's not very well educated. And eventually, like a lot of people in his neighborhood, he was exposed to the Tammany Hall political machine. In that part of New York City and in Smith's life, there were certain institutions that were fundamentally important. One was the Catholic Church. In those immigrant neighborhoods, most of the immigrants were either Catholic or Jewish, and he, being of primarily Irish descent, he was a Catholic. But also the Tammany Hall political machine, this organization, they were basically the Democratic Party in Manhattan. But through all sorts of unscrupulous tactics and bribery and extortion and so forth, they really dominated life in New York City. So he ran into some of these people as a young man. He was sort of taught politics by saloon keepers, started making speeches and doing favors for the machine. And eventually, in the early 20th century, in 1903, he was sent to Albany as a state legislator.
Sent by the political machine.
They decided it was his turn because he had been a good soldier. And he was sent to Albany as an assemblyman. And that was the beginning of what became a very important political career.
And you write that given all that background, quote, Al Smith was an offensive character to most reformers, close quote. He was not, in his early years in politics, seen as a reformer.
No, he was seen as a hack. And the reformers in the Progressive Era were very condescending toward immigrant groups in general. But to be fair, he was kind of a hack. He was sent there because he was loyal to the machine. He didn't give a single speech in his first term as an assemblyman. But what eventually changed was he cared deeply about getting this right. He sensed that he had an opportunity to use this this office to help people who came from a background like himself. And so while the other legislators were out carousing at Albany, Albany's lively nightlife, he was in his hotel studying, learning about the mechanics of state government. And over time, he became widely regarded as a very effective legislator.
The tragic Triangle Shirtwaist Factory fire that killed 146 young women seamstresses erupted March 25th, 1911. How did that affect Al Smith's career?
Well, it changed everything for his career, for New York, and eventually for the country. What had happened is the previous November, the Democrats had taken control of this. Well, they had won the elections, and so that January they had taken control of the state legislature. New York at that time was usually a Republican state. And so suddenly the Democrats were in charge. And when the fire erupted 2.5 months into this, it was the Democratic Party's problem. It was Tammany Hall's problem. Al Smith had been made the majority leader of the state assembly in 1911, and his best friend, a German immigrant named Robert F. Wagner, who had become one of the most important U.S. senators in history, Robert Wagner was made majority leader of the state Senate at that time.
And Wagner would also be part of FDR's
brain
trust during the New
Deal.
Oh,
absolutely. Absolutely. Wagner was probably the senator who was most fundamental to getting New Deal legislation through back when we got to the 30s. But in 1911, what it meant was Wagner and Smith had to deal with this tragedy and with the aftermath of the tragedy. And what happened was they brought in experts on industrial life, on the suffering that went on in these factories. And at that time in America, most of the great experts, the people who had been warning about these kinds of conditions for years, were progressive women. And so they brought in women like, especially Frances Perkins, who was with the New York Consumers League.
Went on to be labor secretary
absolutely.
In the FDR administration.
Yes, and what happened is Frances Perkins became the leading witness on a lot of their investigations, and she took Wagner and Smith to factories all around New York State, and they witnessed some of the horrible conditions. And these progressive labor activists helped write legislation, and they helped sort of craft Tammany Hall's response. And so you get this counterintuitive alliance that forms between these reformist women and these machine men, and it produces this outburst of legislation in 1911 and 12 and 13, and it catapults Smith and Wagner to statewide prominence.
That's historian Robert Childs here on The Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cast. We're talking about his book, The Revolution of 28, Al Smith, American Progressivism, and the Coming of the New Deal. So Smith's elected governor takes office just as the Great War is ending. Public health was one of the first issues he took on. You report that the New York Draft Board had judged, quote, one-third of all the male population in the state of New York between the ages of 21 and 31 years unfit to fight because of diseases or other physical unfitness, close quote. What did Smith do about it?
One of his first initiatives was to try and create a statewide compulsory health insurance program partly funded by the state, partly funded by employers, and partly funded by labor. This was denounced as Bolshevism, and it was defeated by the Red Scare, basically. After World War I, there was tremendous fear of communism. And so, of course, just like in our present day, there are debates about how much the government should be involved in healthcare. But his consolation prize was, over his 4 terms as governor, he was able to get a great deal of funding to build up the healthcare infrastructure of New York State. So they invested in hospitals, in charitable hospitals for the poor or for the mentally ill, but also health clinics in general. They invested, we think of New York, you might think of the city, or you might think of urban New York, but vast stretches of upstate New York are very rural then and now, and some whole counties had no access to healthcare. So they invested in traveling health clinics and nurses and tubercular clinics and all sorts of things. And so and part of the way he was able to get that was you have to pay for these things, and he was able to get the people of New York State to approve a major bond to construct a lot of these hospitals, because the state legislature, which always was Republican in the Al Smith years, he was, of course, a Democrat, they were not always enthusiastic to pay for a lot of his propositions. But this is how he was able to deal with health care.
You mentioned he served 4 2-year terms as governor, but not—he was defeated after his first burst of energy and then came back for 3 more terms. Tell us a couple more of what he accomplished that set him up to be the national candidate of the Democrats in 28.
Well, one of his great achievements, and it's a great legacy of Smith's to this day, was in recreation. Much of that took battles, political fighting by Al Smith to get those parks and beaches established, and conservation of the Adirondacks and Catskills was expanded under Smith. Another great achievement was modernizing education. The public education budget had a 9-fold increase during the Smith years in New York State. And in the meantime, they helped modernize not only schools in the metropolitan region where they were understaffed, and so they started paying the teachers better, but in upstate New York, it was very difficult to fund schools, so they consolidated and modernized schools there as well.
We need to pause here in our conversation with Robert Childs, lecturer in history at the University of Maryland. He also teaches courses at Goucher College and Loyola University, Maryland. His book is The Revolution of 28, Al Smith, American Progressivism, and the Coming of the New Deal. When we're back, we'll talk about the national political coalition he built and whether it holds any meaning today. I'm Sheila Cass. Stay with us.
This is the On the Record podcast, a service of Your Public Radio, member-supported 88.1 WYPR. You can support this podcast and everything you hear from WYPR. Become a member. Come to WYPR.org and click the donate link.
Welcome back to On the Record. I'm Sheila Cast. When New York Governor Al Smith won the Democratic nomination for president in 1928, he carried the baggage of being Roman Catholic, having grown up poor, having risen through the political machine. He used his acceptance speech to promise he would make independent decisions.
I can, with complete honesty, make the statement that my nomination was brought about by no promise given or implied by me or anybody in my behalf. I will not be influenced in appointments by the fact that a man is either rich or poor, whether he comes from the north, the east, the south, or the west, or by what church he attends in the worship of God. The sole standard of my appointment will be the same as they've been in my governorship: integrity of the man or woman, and his ability or her ability to give me the greatest possible aid in devoted service to the people.
We want to thank the Vincent Voice Library at Michigan State University for that audio. Historian Robert Childs is here. We're discussing his book, The Revolution of 28, Al Smith, American Progressivism, and the Coming of the New Deal. Across the country, many people thought Smith couldn't be independent because he was Catholic, that the church would control him. How did that issue play out in the 28 campaign?
Well, it was incredibly ugly the way that it played out. It led to members of the Ku Klux Klan heckling him. There were examples when his campaign train was steaming into Oklahoma for a speech that he was going to give. There were crosses burning on the hillside because they knew this Catholic candidate was coming. The Klan in the 1920s really was at its high point. In 1924, they had an estimated 6 million members. And they were thriving in the 20s, partly because of their ongoing obsession with hating African Americans, as they always had, but also because of fear of immigrants, anti-Semitism and anti-Catholicism were all very strong in the Klan as well. And so this meant that they really got their followers up in arms that year. And it meant that a lot of Democratic politicians who were either in the Klan or sympathetic to the Klan also spoke out against Smith. The most famous was a senator from Alabama, a Democrat, Thomas Heflin, who had been a nasty segregationist, but also virulently anti-Catholic. And he embarked on a national speaking tour in 1928, partly funded by the Klan. It cost Smith votes in many places, and it hurt people who supported him. There were people who took bold stands in the other direction, a very progressive Republican senator from Nebraska, George Norris. And George Norris endorsed Al Smith in 1928, and for the rest of his career, he was dogged by all sorts of propaganda against him in Nebraska, claiming that he was in bed with the Catholics and that he was a closet drinker and so forth and so on. And so the stakes were high on all sides.
You say it cost Smith votes, but did it also, the opposition from the Klan, pull supporters to him?
Absolutely. This is the other and equally significant side of the story. It, of course, got Catholic voters more interested in politics and more interested in the election and supportive of Al Smith. But what I think is even more interesting than that is that other marginalized groups were offended by the Klan, obviously, but by the Klan saying someone couldn't be president because of their faith. And so the black vote was overwhelmingly Republican at this time. And it still was in 1928, but it was starting to shift. And one of the reasons was that some of the leading black papers, including the Chicago Defender and our own Baltimore Afro-American, they endorsed Al Smith largely because of the harassment he was receiving by the Klan and by other bigots because he was a Catholic. And Jewish voters as well were very much attracted to Al Smith, in large part because they could understand religious discrimination. It galvanized people on both sides of the issue.
What did Smith run on in 1928? What was the big issue?
Well, this is an important point that I try to deal with some nuance. When we look back, we focus on the Klan and on Prohibition and on Smith's Catholicism and on tolerance, and those all were issues that he spoke about. But he also made clear that despite the period's reputation for prosperity in the Roaring Twenties, he recognized that there was some reform that needed to be made to make the economy more just and to deal with those who were being left behind. So a few examples of this. One is farmers. The first substantive speech he gave was about farm relief and trying to deal, because for farmers there was no Roaring Twenties. They had been suffering since the early 1920s. Another issue that he talked about was labor and the idea that labor unions were really being hampered by the excessive use of injunctions by the government in this period. Another important—
To stop strikes.
That's right. Mm-hmm. That's right. Another issue was hydroelectric power, whether it should be developed by the government or whether it should be developed by private industry. As governor of New York, he had pushed to have the state of New York control hydroelectric development. He didn't get that in his time, but it would happen in New York later. But nationally, the big controversy for hydropower was at Muscle Shoals, Alabama, and he was calling for the federal government to develop that. This was referred to as socialism and communism by his opponents. So he was denounced for that. And so a lot of working class voters could hear these things and recognize that the New York model was way ahead of the national labor and social welfare situation at that time, which was virtually non-existent. And they could understand in what Smith was talking about potential remedies for their day-to-day problems.
This is On the Record on WIPR. I'm Sheila Cass, discussing the book The Revolution of 28, Al Smith, American Progressivism, and the Coming of the New Deal, with its author, historian Robert Childs. I'm sure some listeners are thinking, how can you call Al Smith's campaign the Revolution of 28 when he lost in a landslide? Explain that.
Well, it's a good point. But what's interesting, I think, is that the people so first of all, there's an incredible shift in who is voting for which party in 1928. Working class voters, especially recent immigrant working class voters, Catholic and Jewish, and generally the urban working class, they shift toward the Democrats in 1928, and they remain there. And what happens is the new coalition that didn't exist before Al Smith's election, and that materialized, started to materialize in 1928, he loses, but they don't go away. And when the Depression happens and when the Democratic Party is looking is able to gain power because of the Depression, because now everybody wants to vote out the Republicans because everybody's mad at Herbert Hoover during the 1932 election, well, the heart of this new coalition that forms starting that really dominates American politics starting in the 1930s, the heart of that coalition is actually created in the 28 election. And it is those sort of ethnic working class voters I'm talking about in the northeastern and midwestern cities. And is that revolutionary? Well, not if it's just an accident. Not if it's just because in 28, demographically, they voted for Al Smith, and in 32, economically, they vote for Franklin Roosevelt. But what I found when I dug more deeply into this is that those same voters actually were embracing Smith's ideas about labor protections and social welfare before the Great Depression was a national phenomenon. And so the agenda that Smith had been talking about even before there was a Great Depression, it was a lot more meaningful to a lot more people by the time the Depression was going, and it really helped shape the ideas of a lot of those working class voters who, as I said, became the heart of FDR's coalition and really the heart of the Democratic voting bloc for the next two generations.
What echoes of 1928 do you see in today's politics?
Well, unfortunately, I guess there are many. If you look at the 1920s, there's a lot from that history that is painfully familiar to us today. It's a time, on the one hand, when the macroeconomic indicators look strong and there's growth, but on the other hand, when we see the poor and the working class falling behind and feeling that they're falling behind, and large segments of the population not enjoying that growth. It's a time of exuberant technological development, and it leads to all sorts of not only economic strength, but entertainment options and sort of modern innovations. But at the same time, those don't seem to be improving the sort of quality of life for rank and file individuals. And it's also a time, the 1920s, when you have this obsession with the term they used at the time, 100% Americanism. This is why the Klan has 6 million members. This is why African Americans and Catholics and Jews and recent immigrants are marginalized. And they have all sorts of immigration, really harsh immigration restrictions that get passed in the 1920s. All those things came together in 1928 to make the election a fascinating one, but also this intersection of class politics and culture politics and how it gets very messy and at times very ugly. I think all of that can echo into our own time.
It is fascinating. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Robert Childs lectures in the History Department at the University of Maryland. He also teaches occasional courses at Goucher College and Loyola University, Maryland. His book is The Revolution of 28, Al Smith, American Progressivism, and the Coming of the New Deal. We've got links to more information at the On the Record page at WIPR.org. I'm Sheila Kast. Thanks for joining us on The Record. Come back tomorrow.
Thanks for listening to this segment of On the Record with Sheila Kast. You can catch the show on the radio Monday through Friday, 9:30 to 10 a.m. on 88.1 WYPR, your NPR news station. And you can support On the Record and all the other public radio programs that WYPR brings to you. Just click the donate link at the top of WYPR.org. And thanks.